Caymans, recording an oral history interview with John Hawthorne. Today is the 16th of March 2006, and we're conducting this interview at Cremorne, New South Wales. This will be tape number MPFH 47, side A. Okay, let's go for it, John. John, usually in these interviews we ask a little bit of background information about people, so can you tell me when you were born and where?
I was born at Paddington Hospital, 1945, November 45. And my parents were living at Miller's Point or Dawes Point for 5 years prior to me being born.
Where exactly were they living?
9 Lower Ford Street, Miller's Point.
I know the house. It's next door to Brian Harrison, isn't it?
That's it.
Could you describe the house for me, what it was like in those days when you were born or in your early youth?
Well, it was had 4 floors. There were a basement, ground, first and second floor. And the amount of people in it.
Yeah. How many people lived in the...
27.
In one house?
Yes.
They must have been everywhere.
Everywhere.
How big were the rooms then that they had?
Well, they weren't that big, but... they used the verandas. They used to fill the verandas in and use those as kitchens, and the lounge room and the bedrooms became a lounge room as well. Like there were 2 in 1.
Right.
More or less like bedsitters today. Only you didn't have room as for a separate chair virtually you to sit on. You had to sit on the side of the bed.
And what were the facilities like for those people? Like how many bathrooms were there?
There was 1 toilet and 1 bathroom, and they were in together, and there was a broken down toilet at the very basement, but that never ever worked all the time I lived there, which was 16 years.
Really? So how did you manage to actually get a, you know, a wash and all that? I mean, how long did you have to wait sometimes for that?
Too long sometimes. If you wanted to go to the toilet and someone was in the shower... you just had your towel under your arm or the toilet paper and you just had to run for it.
Were there any regulations about that sort of thing in those days?
No.
So who was your landlady?
Mary Butler, her name was.
What sort of person was she?
Well, like all landladies in them days, I suppose very tough. I remember... she'd run up the stairs and abuse my mother when I was a kid if I'd any running around. That was even when I was 2 or 3 years old, because our place was on top of hers. And she was pretty tough.
Right, she would have to be, I suppose, with all those people. How did you manage all those people? Were they easy to manage, or were there some difficult characters among them?
Well, I don't remember. Look, when I was... a baby then, but as I got older, 7 or 8, 9, I mean, she a daughter got married and she had a family and they ran it for her then. And there was some, you know, used to get a bit drunk on Saturday nights and that sort of thing, but no, it was pretty good.
What were the occupations of the men?
Mostly seamen or waterside workers.
So the people actually had permanent jobs at Miller's Point, were they?
Well, around in the vicinity. Some were wharfies and some went to sea, so there was the seamen's pickup was only just behind the Harbour View Hotel. So it was pretty central to everything.
What was the seamen's pickup?
It was in Gloucester Street. It's where I think the Aboriginal art or dance studios are now. On the east side of the Harbour Bridge. And seamen used to go there to get picked up off the roster there.
I see. What, if they wanted to crew for ships, you mean?
That's right, yeah.
To go away?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, okay. Right. Now, what tell me, describe to me where your family lived in that house at 9 Lower 4th Street. What rooms they occupied? How many rooms and so on?
We had one room and a baby's room that you could only get a bed in, and one cupboard, and a veranda which was used as a kitchen. As I said, all the verandas were filled in.
So you had a makeshift kitchen, or was it the proper kitchen?
Oh, no, it was a proper kitchen. It had a built-in tables and chairs at one end, and the stove and fridge went along. Well, not the fridge, the ice chest in them days. It was at the other end.
Right. It was your room, the baby's room, was it?
The baby's room, yeah. Until I was 16, yeah.
Not much room to swing a cat there, was it?
No. Yeah.
That's all you could fit in, a bed and a little dressing table?
Dressing table, that was it, yeah. Hmm.
So is it, people put up with things in those days, did they? I mean, what was it?
Well, I suppose you didn't know different. You just accepted that, you know, and it didn't... Everyone else you went to that had similar sort of circumstances, so you didn't... you didn't sort of accept if I went to the country where my relatives lived, I'd notice any difference, but because they lived in houses, but anyone else we knew lived in the city all had similar accommodation.
Right. And what did your parents do for a living?
My father managed the Harbour View Hotel, and my mother worked there as a barmaid, and then eventually they both left, and my mother became a cleaner at the health department, which was in George Street North, which became the old spaghetti factory, and I'm not sure what it is now. And my father became a watchman on the wharves.
Right. When he was managing the Harbour View Hotel, when you say managing, do you mean he was the boss?
Yes. He didn't own it. He managed it for someone.
Right. What sort of a life is it being a sort of a publican's son? How did you enjoy life there?
We used to live in 9 Lower 4th Street, which is only 100 yards down the road from the pub, but I don't remember much about the pub. I just remember being in there a few times and going down to the cellar with my father, which was all pretty damp and wet, and I remember him saying to me, "Don't walk down the stairs frontwards, you've got to always walk down them backwards." That's about recollections of it, actually.
Now, was there a ladies' lounge in the hotel?
Yes, there was, yeah. All the pubs had ladies' lounges in them days.
What would women do when they came there to have a few drinks and so on?
Well, a couple of times I've seen women there with the hair in rollers and shelling peas, but I mean, not specific that one, but any of the pubs, it was a similar sort of a thing.
So they used to carry on shelling peas for the pub or for their own houses, was it?
Oh, for tea that night. At their own home, yeah.
Right, so to bring that work with them.
Yeah.
While they had a beer.
Yeah.
We've heard from other interviewees that quite a few people had alcoholic problems. There was a lot of alcoholism around. What's your recollection of all that?
Well, the pubs were filled every night in them days. The husbands are in the pub quite a few of the mothers were, and not at night, up till tea time, as I said, but it was a thing that I think it was because of the, when the 10 o'clock trading had come in, I think, was it 54 or... 54 or 50, but it was a carry-on from that, I think. And they just... and there was no fitness thing around that for anyone in those days, and that was just what was done.
You ever see drunks walking in the street?
Drunks?
Mm.
Oh, all the time.
People had too much and went home.
Yeah.
At least they couldn't drive. They didn't have far to go, I suppose. Now,
I remember one time I was... On a Sunday morning, I was delivering papers, and I seen a bloke and the woman he lived with, and they were blind, blind drunk. It was a Sunday morning early, and he was into a bashing her in the street, and in Lower Fort Street. And I went home and told my mother, and I said, "Oh, you know, poor woman." And she said, "Well, doesn't matter what happens. Like, you never interfere with marital things, no matter what. You just got to do what you done." Turned, because I was only about 10-year-old, 9 or 10, and she said, "You just got to keep walking. That's a good lesson for you. Remember that."
Now, were people in Millers Point generally fairly religious? Did they go to church a lot?
No. No, not many went to church.
So they'd be pretty empty on a Sunday, were they, those churches?
I'd say after church, went out on 1 o'clock on Sundays, there'd be only us kids just roaming around. There wouldn't hardly see any people in on the street at all.
Now tell me about some of the exploits that you did as a kid, the things you used to do.
Regards?
Playing games or swimming or entertainment, that sort of thing.
Well, we used to scale the trams over to North Sydney and swim at North Sydney Pool and go to Luna Park, because that wasn't, you weren't charged into it in those days. You only paid for the rides or whatever you want. And all of us were barred from the basketball. They had a basketball game. You could win chocolates, which were no good anyway. They were 6 months old. But because we used to play basketball at King George Playground, we could all shoot baskets, and they knew us, so we were barred from that. We were never allowed to. But, we used to have a good time over there. And we used to go to the movies at Crow's Nest and the Orpheum picture show at North Sydney. I think we used to take like 2 bob would get you, I think it was 11 pence in the movies. I think it was 4 cents for a packet of chips. Drink was probably, which was cordial, was probably about 5 cents, and you'd get a cob or 2 cobbers for a penny. That'd, because you'd get your fare over and back for nothing on the tram, and that was a bit, you'd spend your, it'd cost you 2 bob for the whole lot.
In those days, I guess 2 bob was something, was it?
Oh, yeah, I suppose, yeah.
Now, you people were all living in a heritage area. Was there much thought given to that, or the history?
No, never. No, I never. Never ever contemplated that.
Now, when I saw you earlier, you told me a story about burning the cedar furniture or something.
Well,
tell me about that.
Yeah, my father told me it was cedar. I mean, this old furniture that Mary Butler had throughout the house. And one Saturday, all the furniture, everyone had to take their furniture down, not on one day, but over a short period. And my father to chop it all up and for her, and the whole lot up, and it all had to be burnt. And even if you wanted any part of it, none of it was to be kept. She got all this stuff, like, I suppose you'd call it, like, not freedom, plastic. It wasn't plastic, but Macy type of furniture, I suppose. Prefab stuff and all that.
That replaced the good cedar furniture.
Oh yeah, yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Oh, well, even then, I used to like old stuff. Which I've got a few old things at home, and I had to sell quite a few when I moved into my unit. But I sort of even appreciated it then. But there's no avail. You sort of remember me saying, "I've got to chop it all up
and burnt it all."
Oh yeah, it was used for the copper, which everyone used to use for to wash the clothes in.
Well, that's a good use of cedar furniture, isn't it?
Mm.
Oh, my God. Right. Now, did you, as a child, did you ever go up on the bridge pylons?
Oh, I used to go up to the pylons, yeah. They had the white cats up there and a big, I suppose it'd be 6 or 7 foot width across, and how to milk cows. Like, must have been mechanisation of dairy cattle must have come in around that time, and it showed how they moved around and what was done on that with all these little lead cows and things. They had farmers there, like little lead farmers and things like that. It was just an explanatory thing with it.
Where was that, in the bridge panel itself?
Yes, it was up where the cats are, where the telescopes are. And there was a room up there, or a couple of rooms up there, I think. It was all in that area.
So was this sort of an exhibition space, was it?
Yeah, it was, because people would go up to... it was the highest point in Sydney in them days. And they'd go up to look at... And then I think it was 10 cents in or something. They'd have a look at these things up there.
So is this the milk board that put this up, do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure who it was. I remember the thing well. And the cats, these white Persian cats.
We've heard of a cat lady who lived up there as well, was there?
Yeah, well, she had the cats. It was it was a paid thing. She wasn't just living there with nothing. It was advertised. You know, with see the white Persian cats at the Poland lookout. As I said, it was the tallest part of Sydney. And then they built the next building they built then was at near the Dunbarton Hotel or opposite. It was the AMP built one then. That was a taller point. That was the tallest building in Sydney, rather, at the time. I remember that being built. That was the tallest lookout, the pylon.
Right. So the cats was just like a tourist attraction too, was it?
Yeah.
Right. So stuff that doesn't exist anymore?
No. You think now it seems a bit strange, doesn't it? Does that happen?
People who look at cats and leaden cows, I mean, it's strange. Yeah. So where did you swim in Millers Point?
Well, we'd go to North Sydney Pool. We'd go down to the Domain, which was the Boy Charlton pool down at Woolloomooloo, which was... tidal bars in those days, and we used to also swim down at they call the Metal Wharf, which was 10 Walsh Bay.
No sharks there?
I never seen any. Some of the others said they seen a stingray that was that big it couldn't get through between the piles, but I don't know, I didn't see it. I never seen any sharks, but they're supposed to be there because in those days the crew was, they'd just throw rubbish over the side and the toilet and all everything, all the refuse from the kitchen would all go into the harbour. So, you know, there was no one, I suppose, that did attract sharks there. But some kids did say they'd seen sharks.
Yeah, right. Now, apparently there were some fires that you saw. Tell me about those.
Well, there was one down at... opposite where my mother used to work, which is the corner of George Street North and Nixon Road, I suppose. It goes right around. And there was a big fire there one weekend. It was a toy factory. And they, when it had stopped, all the kids had all these marbles and records and use them as frisbees, and they were the big 45 records, and there was bears and plastic dolls and all that sort of thing. It seemed to be a cheap sort of a toys, I think, at the time.
How come there were records in a toy factory?
I don't know. They must have either imported them, and that was... they certainly wouldn't have made them there, but I don't know.
Do you know the reason for the fire? Why?
No, I don't.
It was a big one, was it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it burnt all the inside of it. They pulled it down. There's another building on it now. It's on the corner of the lane opposite the Observer Hotel. It was on that block there and went up from that lane up to Playfair Street.
What sort of things used to happen at Millers Point on Guy Fawkes Night? Tell me about that.
Well, they had the big bonfires in the bottom of High Street, and the kids at the point always hoped that they'd get one bigger than the kids at the Loo, but the ones at the Loo used to get a mention in the paper the day after Guy Fawkes Day, that they'd have so many brigades to come down and put them out, and they'd get them going again, but they used to always get them. We never got a mention in the paper, or maybe once, but ours might have been 20 foot high, 25. Theirs seemed to be 30 foot high. They were massive.
Used to damage the roads a little, what?
Nah.
So what sort of stuff they used to burn then?
Well, like kids would get car tyres and bits of dunnage off the wharves and anything at all you could get your hands on to just build it up higher and higher.
Now, you've had some association with the SB Bookies, they tell me.
Yeah, I used to work for SB Bookie Seth Moore when I was 11, and they used to give me 10 bob a week, which is a dollar in today's, and I'd run sheets between our two premises, one in Windmill Street and one next to the Harbour View Hotel, and I'd go and get cigars and matches and run sheets for him down to the other betting place or vice versa, and I'd done that for a couple of years with him.
So would you say you were kind of his assistant?
Oh, I had assistants inside, but I was only a kid, but that's when I started punting.
As a child, you were betting. Yeah. How much were the bets, say? Tell me a bit about the...
Oh, two bob each way, 2 bob, 50 cents, or 5 bob. If I didn't do well, I'd... The 10 bob he'd give me, it'd be gone in 2 or 3 races. In fact, since I've been 11, I haven't been to work or school on Melbourne Cup Day since I've been 11.
So how did you go on the Melbourne Cup days?
Well, the first one I wagged, my mother found out, and I said, well, I'm not going to go anymore, and on Melbourne Cup Day, so she allowed me to have it off. And then from when I started working, I've never gone on Melbourne Cup Day, so I'm 60 now, so I've seen 49 straight that I haven't been to work on. So I don't know whether that's a good record or not, but it's a record anyway.
Did you build up a piggy bank of savings from?
Oh, yeah, I had... I could do no wrong when I was a kid punting till I was about 16, and then I've been able to do no right since. And always had between 30 and 90 pound in a little pink gold, like a pirate's chest on my, and I had papers on top of it, inside it, and the money underneath, and I'd used to give my mother money at times, and... My father was getting £5 a week, and I always had somewhere between 30 and 90 pound in there, and I sort of thought back over the years and thought, you know, had a fortune there at that time. As I said, once I turned 16, the luck ran out, and I could count them on one hand, the amount of winners I've backed since.
Oh, what a shame.
Not quite, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, an absolute fortune, that was £60. Yeah,
absolute fortune.
£90 is a lot of money. Oh. You could buy a house almost for that.
Probably. But you never... Yeah, well, if I can, just away from the point, I remember my mother told me that she bought a block of land. Well, you're right, because she bought a block of land just a little bit by the wayside at the headland between Harbord and Curl Beach, or somewhere in one of those, and it was she bought it for £30 and sold it for £90, and that was before I was old enough to remember, so it's probably about when I was probably 4 or 5, and my father sold it over the north side, wouldn't, it'd never catch on over there, and she sold it to a copper who had a block next door, and years later I seen a rate notice she had, and it was 10 bob a year, the rates. So it'd be worth anything now.
Yeah, that's right.
I've still got that rate notice, actually.
Have you? £10. Yeah, people like to get back to that one.
Yeah.
So you left school pretty early, did you? What age were you when you left?
15.
Why did you leave so early?
Well, everyone left school at 15 in those days, and no one went on. I don't remember anyone going on. Rassi Taylor went on because he was extremely smart. He went had an opportunity school he went to, but and there was an opportunity class at Fort Street Primary where we went, but all the kids just, a lot of the kids had left and went to sea and got done trades, and that was sort of the way it went.
Was it expected that you would get a job in the wharves or something?
Probably, eventually, when you're old enough. You had to be 20 year old.
What did you want to do?
Well, I wanted to be an auctioneer at first, or a race broadcaster, and I tried to do both, and that didn't work out, and I finished up, I went to work at Goldsby Moor as a clerk for about 12 months or 15 months, and I couldn't get, when the auctioneering thing wasn't going to work out for me, and I'd already been knocked back for jobs at radio stations as to get in and the ground floor was to be a broadcaster. And I used to go to the races and call them to myself, hire the binoculars out there and call them to myself, and then my mother would tape the races when I got a tape recorder and come home and listen to them to see how I went. But once that never happened, I got a job as an apprentice painter, and then I eventually got on the wharves when I was 19. And it had to be 20, but I used someone else's birth certificate to get on at 19.
Right. We'll just take a break. I've got to change tapes.
Okay.
This is the end of tape number MPFH47, side A. Continuation of an oral history interview with John Hawthorne. This is tape number MPFH47, side B. Now, John, you started on the wharves at 19. Were you still single, or had you met someone by that stage?
No, I was married. I was married at 19. And I was on the wharves. And I was there a couple of years, and permanency came in on the waterfront, which was all casual then, and permanency came in 1967, and we were getting $2.80 a day, which was 28 bob, or £1.08 a day, and I couldn't live on that, and then I became a painter and docker. And I done that for a few years, and then I got back on the wharves as a tally clerk.
Tell me a bit about those early years on the wharf, the first years. What were you doing?
Well, I had, in those days, they had 15-man gangs, and they always had half a dozen below, and you'd put the cargo in these giant nets, and they'd send them out, and if you're on the wharf, everything was all mechanical, of course, and they had a yard arm and a midship, as they call, for the derricks to bring the cargo over, and to drop on the wharf, and you'd put it on big wooden barrows because there was no forklifts in those days, and the barrows sort of around 7 foot tall and really thick frame things, and they'd stack them up and you'd wheel them into the sheds, and there was no pallets, of course, and everything went on the ground and was all marked out for you by tally clerks in the shed, and was stacked in there by, they call stackers in the shed, and when the trucks had come down to pick it up, they'd back the trucks into the shed, and then the poor old truck drivers would have to stack it back up on the whole lot, back up onto a truck, and then take it back all off again.
What was the merchandise?
Oh, just general cargo, anything. Bags, cartons, cases.
Right, did you carry the wheat bags as well?
Well, we used to call, everyone had a hook. You'd have a hook and a petticoat, your mother's petticoat or your wife's petticoat for the flour jobs, and you couldn't work without it if you didn't have a hook. In fact, my memory now, I think they'd send you home if you didn't have it, if you didn't have your hook.
What was the petticoat for?
Well, on flour jobs, which had run for 3 weeks, you'd have the flour bags on your shoulders, and your shoulder would wear out quickly with a T-shirt on or even a singlet or whatever, and you needed the petticoat for the slide on it.
To carry it on your shoulders.
That's right.
Oh, your skin would chafe off, would it, without the petticoat?
Oh, yeah. Everyone used to have them.
Right, an interesting use for a petticoat.
Yes.
Right. So what were the facilities like for the men? I mean, like washing facilities and cleaning up afterwards, that sort of thing.
Yeah, the showers had been in a while in some of them, and but some of the older wharves at 24, 25 Piermont, they still didn't have facilities, amenity rooms, and you'd just hang your nails in the shed and you'd just hang it up, and took the odds, the pigeon shit or whatever, over your clothes, and you couldn't have a shower after work or anything like that. You'd just have to put your clothes back on, and not, you know, some had cars and some didn't in them days. So you, the public transport, you got on as you were.
Is that because there were no showers?
Well, they hadn't been built. They hadn't been provided for it at those certain wharves.
Was there much of a movement of agitation towards getting those sort of facilities?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, the union movement was becoming strong then. Like in those days, Jimmy Healy was the federal secretary, and I mean, things were pressing on to get all those sorts of things and conditions, because like only probably 10 years before me, they and probably not even that long, 8 years before, they were at a system where they called the bull system, where they used to come to the gate and the foreman would come out and just pick heads, and if you were a boss's man or a good worker or more, they were boss's man, you got picked, and the others were sent home and never got picked.
And never got paid, I suppose.
Well, they never got anything. They just never got picked up at all.
That was the bull system.
That was the bull system.
You know why they call it the bull system?
Yes, because you had to work like a bull to get picked up again. You had to be bullish in your work attitude.
Was it the big guys that got the work then?
Oh, no, just... No, they just... well, it wasn't in my time, but it was just whoever was a... they deemed it to be a bull.
Now, the bull system was replaced by the gang system, wasn't it?
The gangs come in, yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they had... They would have had the gangs then. You didn't work in gangs because it was all casual, but they would have worked probably as a gang and just put in different things. But in the gang system, well, you joined a gang and you had... You know, you work with your gang. Then if you... you were sick or at any time and you missed, you didn't go straight back into your gang, you had to go back onto the roster and wait till your gang was off and got picked up again in the same day so you could join them again.
Were you also part of a gang?
Oh, yes, yes. We used to work the Union Company ships, mainly all the Darling Harbour run, which was the good run, and the island ships and the Kiwi boats and the deep sea was, as it was termed, as was all along Walsh Bay, which were the heavy duty sort of work, and it wasn't as good as where we were.
Was it dangerous work on the wharves?
Oh yes. Well, there'd been plenty die there. I mean, there's plenty had to dive off logs and on midnight ships, shifts when they'd been at Snails Bay at Birch Grove, and they even in them days they used to have them in front of where I used to live, to Walsh Bay, and the logs used to be, they'd take them off and at any, look, most of the wharves actually, when if they just had that bit of bit more clearance between the adjacent wharf, but I'd nearly been speared with steel pipes and things coming out of a sling that broke loose, and on the wheat you'd be it was a job that the foreman used to do, spraying wheat in ships at Glebe Island in the wings of the ship, and you were sit behind him and watch him, and a couple of times I thought, one time in particular, I thought a foreman had died and been pulled the little blowing machine up that far off the big rubber, big hose, which was probably about a foot or foot to 18 inches wide, and I thought it had flattened him, and I'd rang the bell to cut the weed off, and he was sitting there watching it. He'd just left it. Well, he had a bit of a blow himself, and I got abused for that. But, there's been plenty of people. I've seen a bloke got his finger chopped off one night on a hatch when we were closing the hatches, not in the gang I was in, but, yeah, there's plenty of men killed.
How many men were working on the waterfront when you joined?
I think about 8,000. And I think there's probably now about 800.
So what was the big change on the waterfront? Was it the mechanisation that came in?
Containers, yeah.
Tell me about that. You must have been there when they came in.
Yeah, the first ship, it was at Discovery Bay at where I worked as a tally at Seatainer Terminals at Balmain. And it was the first of quite a few of the bay boats. It was Encounter Bay, can't think of them now. I've been to say them and I can't think. But there was a succession of those.
So what effect did it have on the workforce at Millers Point when those container ships came in?
I think everyone was sort of already on the waterfront then. And in my era, and once naturally the jobs started to disappear, well, no one picked up off the waterfront. No one went into those industries because it was harder to get into them. I mean, they picked up, the wharfies didn't ask for wharfies recruitment as often, and tallies, everything was the same. I mean, the work just dropped, so there was naturally less need for the men.
Was there a lot of unemployment then in Millers Point, and people couldn't find jobs, or what happened?
When I was a kid, or in this time with the waterfront?
Well, the changes due to the containerisation, let's say, when the jobs, you said, started disappearing.
Well, so I'd left then. I'd gone. I went back to live at Millers Point. When I'd been married, I went to number one Walsh Bay, overlooking one Walsh Bay, number one Lower Ford Street, and I lived in a similar, actually it was only one big room and a kitchen veranda. And then I moved up to 57, or where, next door to Shirley Ball, where she lives, whatever number she is, it was the number, the lower side of hers.
Right.
And
all in boarding houses?
Even they were boarding houses, yeah.
Even after you got married?
Yes.
Right.
And it, that's where my wife found the body. Did you want me to?
No, tell me about
that. My wife, we used to clean the stairs and do the rooms once a week. And she went up one morning and if we could smell something sweet for a few days. And there was a chap up the top had put a rifle under his chin and blowing his whole head off virtually. He was backwards on the bed and my wife came running downstairs and she said he's got a gun. I thought someone had gone berserk at the time and we slammed the door up and then after a few minutes I got her calmed down. She was hysterical naturally and found out that it had happened a few days before and the landlord, who I was talking about landlords being tough, wanted my wife to clean all the shit off the walls and clean the mattress up even. And actually, when I refused, we just left. We were gone within days. We went to Balmain.
Was that at number 1 Lower Fort Street or 57 Lower Fort Street?
57.
That's 57.
Yeah. Mm.
Terrible, tragic thing.
Mm.
Now, you became a tally clerk on the wharves. Now, we haven't actually interviewed any tally clerks yet. You're the first. So can you tell me what kind of work that was, what you had to do as a tally clerk?
Well, the tally clerks on the water, before I get to mine, what they used to do when I was a wharfie on what they call the conventional side, which was not non-container area, the old way, they used to mark the shed out with white chalk, and all the tallies always had chalk and a pen and a grey dust coat, and that was their job to keep track of the cargo. And when I went to White Bay, the containerisation was we used to load trains at an inbuilt crane on the wharf, and they'd take them up to the depots. There was depots at Villawood and Chalora and a land one at, and another one at by road only at Alexandria. And we used to just documenting the incoming and outgoing of containers.
You used to keep a track of what went in and out, you mean? Was that the job
That's
of
right.
a tally clerk?
Yeah.
Right. How many tally clerks were there in those days?
There was 104 at when I was at White Bay. That was three rotating shifts. It never closed. It closed for an hour between 6 and 7 of a morning.
Really? So you used to work the shifts?
Work the shifts, yeah.
Now, was the job of a tally clerk really to stop things disappearing from the wharves, like pilfering and sort of thing?
No, a watchman's job was that. Tally clerks was just to count what had been brought in or tally what was going out. And they did do it, like if you're putting containers on trucks, well, you'd have to, and documentation for that, or on the other side, they'd have to count how many bags or how many cartons the truck driver was taking. It was the right count. And
right. So did you know about the timetables of the trains, that sort of thing? You have to know all that?
Oh, I know. They had a station master there. He handled all that.
So your job was basically to mark the number of containers, was it, that came off a ship or what?
Yeah, we used to do it all with little blocks and things. It was all done with that type of thing. And tell the wharfies and the cranes which one to put on the train. And they used to have that called ITVs, internal transit vehicle. It'd bring them from under the wharf, under the getting dropped on the on the ITVs on the from the ship, and then they'd come into the shed, and then other cranes would take them off and put them in stacks, because we had stacks 5 high And you had to keep track of all those, and you had to have someone there documenting that, where they went in, what position when they came in.
Right. So they were numbered and you knew what was in them, did you, in terms of goods?
Yeah, and the export they did, and the stuff coming in we didn't know. Well, didn't, you know, you didn't know virtually what was in.
But your job was to put them on the right train or the right truck?
Yeah, right truck, and they had to go out, yeah.
Now, the facilities weren't very good in those days for the trucks, were they? I mean, tell me a bit about...
Well, sometimes it'd be a couple of days. Truck drivers could be, on, even in Hickson Road, lined up when containers come to the, what do I say, the other side, they'd call it, conventional side. Trucks could be there for 2 days while waiting in line, and, you know, there'd be, if anyone tried to push in, there'd be some... arguments about that, or even where we were at Wide Bay, the dry, when it initially kicked off because of the everyone was firing to everyone, the work, it was they were there a couple of days as well for, you know, some months.
How would you be able to stay in line for 2 days? I mean, what about having to go and eat and have breaks and things?
Well, they didn't move very quick, but they'd use pubs or anything to go to the toilet and duck up the road, and some leave their keys, but someone would move their truck up for them. And but they could be 600 or 700 metres long, the queues.
Just huge, huge lines of trucks, were there?
Mm.
Waiting there to... Mm. Is this before the container port terminal was built in Botany, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, this is...
Which years are we talking about now?
Well, Seatainers closed, opened in 69 and closed in 81, I think. Might have been 82. But, I mean, it wasn't like that then, but in the early part it was.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting time, isn't it? And they really needed that to improve that.
Mm.
There was nowhere for the trucks to be, I suppose. Did they take up most of the street or what?
Well, they used to park down the middle of the road, at Hickson Road. They'd park right down the middle. And coming into Wide Bay, they'd park in the middle of the road there as well. And then there was a couple hundred metre run into the... And then up right up the road, there'd be 600 metres.
Right. Wow. So how much did the containerisation change the practices on the wharves, do you think?
Oh, totally. Totally. Everything was just different.
Did people adjust to that, the people of Millersport? To those big changes that happened?
Well, as I said, I'd moved away then. I'd just got on the waterfront, and I mean, everyone just like anything, everyone adjusts.
How many years were you a tally clerk?
Nearly 13.
Right. So you left the waterfront, and what did you do?
I bought a pub.
You had saved up enough to buy a pub?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a home that was worth a lot of money. So...
That was your home in Millers Point or where?
No, Balmain.
Balmain.
Mm.
Which pub and where was it?
Cricketer's Arms at Balmain.
Okay.
It's now the Monkey Bar.
It's called the Monkey Bar?
The Monkey Bar the last 6 years or so, 7 years, 8 years.
How did you take to running a pub?
Probably, yeah, it was good at first, but last 18 months I'd had enough.
Profitable?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Now, you talked to me earlier about some of the things that you witnessed at 51 Lower Fort Street. Was it 51 or 57? Could have been 51, was it?
51 it was.
Yeah.
That's it. It was 51.
That's 51.
51, yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Now...
I also lived in 38 Lower Fort Street.
When
I was a kid, because I went from number 9 Lower Ford Street, and my mother bought the key money to the the premises, a woman was moving out, and she bought the key money for £50, and we were only in there 6 months, and we got kicked out.
Why?
By the Maritime. Well, we hadn't gone through the right channels.
Oh, I see what you mean. Because they owned everything, and
yeah.
So your mother, in fact, for a short period, became a landlady, did she?
No. 38 was just a. It was two stories, but they were a set of flats that you had your own. You had your own place in these. That these weren't. No, these weren't. These each one, each floor was a different. It was different to 51 and the other side of the road. These were had your own autonomy on each floor. There was no landlady. That the Maritime owned each separate flat.
Was it 58 or 38?
38.
38.
Yeah.
They were fortunate.
Yeah, but he'd had no shower in it, and you had to boil up a copper for a bath in that.
Now tell me about the. Another tragic event at the Dumbarton Castle that you witnessed or heard about.
Well, I didn't witness it because I was a kid, but there was a chap, Jackie Carolan, and who used to drink at the hotel and used to train greyhounds, Jack, and he was had gave the publican something to mine for him, and some months later when he asked him for it back, he... the publican denied it, and an argument took place, and he went home and jumped the counter with a small axe, and the publican emptied the gun into him when he on his way over the bar, and the publican was maybe I think he might have been charged with murder at first, but because he'd put so many bullets into him and didn't empty the gun completely.
He was charged with murder, was he?
I think so, and then it was broken down. Might have been manslaughter, but he finished up. He beat the charge. He beat the charge completely, which I think he was lucky to do. Emptied the whole gun into the man.
Was Jack,
6 or 8 bullets, whatever it was.
Was Jack Carolan a kind of an underworld figure, was he?
Oh, no, but he was... he was pretty... knew how to get a quid for himself.
There's some interesting characters come out of Millers Point. Danny Chubb is one of them, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Any other stories you can tell me about the boarding houses? Any interesting little anecdotes, perhaps?
No, not really. I don't know. I can't.
So how long did you actually live in Millers Point altogether, would you say?
Total years. It'd be probably going on 19.
Right. And after you left Millers Point, you said you...
upwards of 20 years, I suppose.
You bought the pub. What did you do after the pub? What kind of work?
Oh, I've just been working in an air freight depot, checking air freight now. Just like tally clerks work again.
Right. You're doing that today?
Yeah.
What, this morning?
Yeah. All the set till 3 o'clock. Yeah.
Right, okay.
No, I just changed a bit of when I came over.
Right. So the conditions have been quite different from those old days, are they?
On the waterfront?
The work that you're doing now. With what you did before.
Yeah, things have changed. I mean, the wharfies had a very tough struggle, you know. It wasn't for them that a lot of other people wouldn't have got conditions that they get because it was a flow on to all other industries.
How do you look back now at your years at Millers Point? What kind of an image do you have of Millers Point now?
Well, it was good to grow up there. I'm glad I did grow up there. We had fun there, I suppose, you know, in those days that you... and there wasn't much for kids to do in them days, you know. And I suppose that we still had fun, I suppose. But it's just good all I can say. I'm glad I did grow up there.
Kept any friends from those days, have you?
Yeah. Well, Russ Taylor and we go away and our families and on holidays. We've just been away 3 months ago with our families up to Byron Bay in previous years, and we go out to dinner at Craig Roberts, Desi Gray, Boris, I see Boris from time to time. They were all at my 60th birthday, which was 4 months ago, except Craig, he is up in Queensland at the moment. Yeah, and still see some of the others from time to time, yeah.
Do you think your life's changed a bit since you lived at Millers Point? Did it influence you, who you are now?
Oh, probably not, no. Probably not. Probably just... just got older.
Right. Okay, well, we're coming to the end of our interview. Is there anything else you wanted to say here?
Oh, no, I think that's about it, yeah.
Well, thanks very much, John, for the for your recollections. Much appreciated. So I'll just close the interview. This is the end of the interview with John Hawthorne and the end of tape number MPFH 47, side B.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.